Support comes from Empower Missouri, which believes a criminal record shouldn't be a lifetime sentence of poverty. Empower Missouri is working to automate expungement of criminal records. More at empowermissouri.org.
From St. Louis Public Radio. This is Politically Speaking. It's April in the Missouri General Assembly, and that means that senators are digging into the state budget. After the House passed its version of the financial plan for the 2025 fiscal year, lawmakers like Senator Brian Williams of University City will make major changes going forward. Williams joins us on the latest episode of Politically Speaking to talk about his priorities for the state budget and whether the legislature can renew a critical tax that helps fund the state's Medicaid program. Let's hit the music.
This is the Politically Speaking podcast, the definitive show about Missouri politics.
My promise to St. Louis was that I would do the absolute most for each and every person, starting with those who have the very least.
What I wanted to do was look and see what other states are doing.
We have to be willing to change those laws, that they are balanced and they affect everybody equally.
As somebody that grew up in the St. Louis area, in North St. Louis County, I didn't know any lawyers growing up.
We got to find long-term solutions to make government better, but also to be able to provide services to people.
I don't want to leave that federal money that we've been leaving all these years on the table.
We need to be spending this money to take care of Missourians.
I thought we accomplished a lot this year, but a lot more needs to be done.
And welcome to Politically Speaking. I am your host, St. Louis Public Radio's Jason Rosenbaum. Joining me from Jefferson City, she covers all things state government and state politics for St. Louis Public Radio.
Sarah Kellogg.
And joining us once again, he is the senator for the 14th District, which includes a whole host of municipalities in St. Louis County. Our special guest today is
Brian Williams.
I want to talk about the state budget. The House passed the budget last week. It's going to be going to the Senate Appropriations Committee, which you are a member. What are your general expectations about the budget this year?
Well, you know, it'll be a little bit different this year, just considering the fact that we're coming up on the tail end of a influx of federal dollars, which we've been able to do some things in that has never been really done in a state budget history, in particular issues and different things that we've been able to fund, transformative projects, to be able to do a lot of things in St. Louis. From my perspective, I don't think that it's going to be as much spending as we've been fortunate to be able to do for really meaningful things in the past couple of years post-pandemic. But I do think there are some opportunities to fund some really good projects and get a really solid budget done this year.
At the end of the year, that's the deadline for the allocation of all the ARPA funding, end of 2024. Are there concerns that all that money isn't going to be allocated before the deadline? And there's thoughts of it, you know, you have till 26 to spend it, but like kind of thoughts on that process?
Well, I think the Senate and I think the legislature has done a really good job of funding projects throughout the entire state. I mean, even if you talk about projects in St. Louis that my office has been able to lead around the Advanced Manufacturing Innovation Center or demolition of Jamestown Mall. Clearly, the big one that everyone notices, the I-70 development. On our side, the I-270 development, which growing up in North St. Louis County, I never envisioned that interstate being developed and being walkable and safe. And you know, so it's been some just really positive things that have happened that I think is going to exceed our lifetime, and I'm really proud to be a part of it.
For this year's budget, the House ended up not appropriating as much money as Governor Parson wanted. Was that surprising to you?
No, I won't say it was surprising to me, but again, you know, I'm fortunate to be in a position where I enjoy working with folks and getting things done. And I have to give some credit to our governor that he's done a tremendous job identifying opportunities to invest in our state. And, you know, the legislature has some folks who think we should cut in areas and we should add money in places. And I think it's just really finding that balance between what he sends over and really what collectively the legislature thinks we should spend money on at the end of the day.
This is similar to prior years where the House has basically allocated less than what Parson asked, and then it goes over to the Senate and it gets changed. Do you think it essentially gives the Senate most of the power to write the budget, especially if Senate Republicans and Democrats from both the House and the Senate join together?
Well, I think that in the Senate, we have a tremendous committee of senators who understand the importance of funding really important projects. I think we've gotten to a place that I really appreciate where we really have put our state first and not really get concerned in districts. And I think that's really created a positive opportunity. And again, coming and working with the House, you know, clearly the House has to agree with the budget at the end of the day. So I think once we come together, I think it's easier to find common ground and find some things that are important to members of the House and then clearly the Senate as well.
With the House process in the budget, they have to decrease something in order to increase it when they're debating on the floor. The Senate doesn't have to do that. How do you feel like that ends up affecting the final outcome?
Well, I think it makes a big difference because, again, we can just fund projects and we can really identify the need and move forward. And I think, you know, clearly I never served in the House, so I haven't experienced that process. But in the Senate, I think we have a very sophisticated process. Our Senate Appropriations Chair has done a great job of prioritizing every member's budget request and, you know, being able to get it done in a timely fashion and limit, you know, unnecessary debate around certain issues and just really get a good budget done and get it done in time.
You know, maybe a rationale for this difference is that since the House and Senate can only negotiate between what the House and the Senate decide on certain budget items, that could mean the state ends up spending less money overall than if both chambers could increase things without decreasing other things. What do you think about that idea?
Well, I mean, again, you know, I think it's going to be important to prioritize important projects. And if we do that, I think that moves our budget forward in the right direction. Again, we're going to have some other things that are important, too. The FRA is another important thing that we have to focus on. And for listeners that aren't familiar with that, we have an opportunity to draw down billions of dollars in Medicaid funding that goes to healthcare systems that fund folks that, you know, fall within the safety net of folks, seniors that are on a fixed income. So it's going to be really important to get that done. And that's going to be something that's just as crucial and as important as getting the budget done. So there's a lot of moving parts. But again, just being on the Senate Appropriations Committee and the process that we have and how we've been able to do it in the past with a lot of money, I feel really positive that we'll get something done.
And we'll talk about the FRA in a minute, but I want to talk about some specific things. First of all, are there any specific priorities that you have in terms of projects or funding focuses that would help the 14th Senatorial District, which, as I mentioned on the outset, includes a number of municipalities in central and northernish St. Louis County?
Well, it's 42 municipalities to be exact. And, you know, what I love about my district and the region I represent some of the wealthiest communities in the state, as well as some of the more poverty-stricken ones. And to be able to find a good balance between ensuring that every part of the region gets the resources that it needs has been something that I've been very proud of. One of my priorities this year is clearly investing in the University of Missouri, St. Louis. So I've been working very close with the UM system, which I'm sure Jason would appreciate as a Columbia alum. But UMSL has had some tremendous success. A year ago, I was able to appropriate $40 million to consolidate and reimagine their South Campus, which for me would ultimately revitalize that Natural Bridge Corridor, which has not seen any investment since the inception of the university in the 60s. And then this year, we're addressing something that's really important, and that's the fact that we have a workforce shortage, in particular when it comes to engineers. UMSL is minutes away from Boeing and so many other entities that has a need for engineers. So right now, I'm making a $25 million appropriation ask for UMSL to get an engineering program, which we believe is going to be a game changer, not just for the St. Louis region, but also for the state of Missouri.
Important disclosure, which everybody who listens to this show knows, we are UM system employees and the University of Missouri St. Louis holds St. Louis Public Radio's license. So just wanted to throw that out there. One of the things that I've been paying a lot of attention to is the shortage of child abuse investigators, specifically in St. Louis and St. Louis County. The House Democrats tried to increase money that would go toward the salaries of these investigators, but it failed what I would classify on procedural grounds. I talked with Cody Smith about it. He's not opposed to paying child abuse investigators more. Their starting salaries are going to be around $44,000, which is just inadequate compared to other places. Do you think that this is something that may come up in the Senate Appropriations Committee process of trying to boost salaries for these people that look into abuse and neglect throughout the St. Louis area and around the state?
Yes, I anticipate it coming up. And, you know, and when it does, and if it does, I anticipate supporting giving not only the investigators an increase in pay, but I really think that we should be focused on creating competitive pay salaries for all state employees. We have lost so many talented individuals to the private sector because of pay. And that's something that we need to prioritize when we do the budget to ensure that we make state employees whole, whether it's our child and abuse investigators to our teachers. It's something that we should be prioritizing. And every opportunity that I get as a member of the Senate Appropriations Committee will be to increase pay for state employees to retain and attract talented individuals.
So with the caveat that the governor has pushed and implemented some pretty aggressive state employee pay increases. If you ask the governor, he's like, well, we got to make sure that we put state employee pay increases in place that are sustainable, especially in bad budgetary times, which is a perfectly reasonable argument. But if you're in a situation where you can't retain child abuse investigators, especially when Illinois is paying their child abuse investigators, from what I've read, $72,000 a year, of course you're going to have situations like where there's a backlog of 6,000 cases in the St. Louis area. So how do you like balance between, you know, trying to be sustainable long term, but actually increasing salaries in certain areas which really need larger than 3.2% boosts?
Yeah, I don't think it's important to really get caught up in which state jobs we should increase funding. I think we should look at which jobs are high need, which jobs or what we still would consider essential employees. Again, that is a job that I think we need to be prioritizing. Same thing with teachers. And again, it's no knock to other state employees, which I think they should be paid a quality wage. But I do think there are some jobs that would be deemed as more essential. And I think that's where we need to focus to keep that balance with sustaining our budget and not putting ourselves into some type of economical or financial crisis in the future.
Now, before we get to the FRA, I have a curveball for you, and the pun is very intended. So be warned. This is a changeup or a knuckleball. I don't know. I'm just
considering you don't like baseball that much, Jason. You're coming out here with the metaphors.
I'm not a baseball fan, but you know, one of the things that I think your committee may deal with in 2025 or 2026, when you're still going to be in the Senate, is the Kansas City Royals may come to the legislature and ask for potentially hundreds of millions of dollars for a new stadium downtown. There was a local tax increase that failed, and so I think they may be looking to the state for help. Now, look, I understand the state helped pay for the Edward Jones Dome. I know they've helped with, you know, St. Louis area stadiums, but I have a long memory. And the Kansas City legislators were some of the biggest opponents to that NFL Riverfront Stadium that faltered in 2015, potentially for good reasons. And I understand a lot of them aren't there anymore. But like, as a St. Louis resident, I'm like, why should we pay for this?
Well, that's a very interesting question. And it is a curveball, no pun intended. First, as a St. Louis diehard St. Louis Cardinals fan, it's really awkward for me to be talking about the Royals in any capacity. But, you know, I will say, again, I think it's so important to invest in downtowns of metropolitan cities and those regions because of the fact that I think that it drives economic activity. I think it serves as the epicenter for that region. And that's something I talk about in St. Louis all the time, is that I think downtown St. Louis is the front door to our region. We should be investing in it. We should make sure that it has resources, economic activity, it's safe. So, you know, because of that firm belief, I do think that I would be interested in figuring out how to help Kansas City be able to thrive and build their downtown, which I think they've done a great job so far. I would be interested in having that conversation, but it would just depends on what the details are. And again, I've taken so much pride in being an advocate for our state and not just solely being consumed into St. Louis as someone who lives there and represent the city. I think it's really important to look and see what the pieces are. And depending on what it is, I'll make a decision at that point.
Moving on to the federal reimbursement allowance, which is something that has to get done this year. It's a tax that hospitals place on themselves to help pay for the state's Medicaid program. There's a lot of concern that this may not pass unless there's a subsequent ban on state funds for Planned Parenthood. How does the Senate get out of this mess?
Well, I think it's going to be important for the Senate to be adults. And that's something that I challenge all my colleagues to do. You know, when it comes to health care and access to it, I'm very passionate about it. I'm very bullish about it. What we've seen in the past couple of years has been a small minority of senators that have tried to hijack a process that has been going on for quite some time. This is the 17th time that we have passed an FRA, meaning that no other legislative session or cohort of lawmakers have ever been held to this standard, that we should put some type of anti-abortion language or access to contraceptive language on a FRA bill. I, you know, as someone who is pro-choice and think that women should make the decisions that they choose with their bodies, I definitely don't think we should use anti-abortion language to hijack that process. So again, it's going to require senators being adults, doing what's right for our state, doing what's right for our healthcare systems. And if that happens again, as it's happened in the past, then we'll be fine. If we let a small group of senators hijack the process and take partisan positions, then I think it's going to cause some problems.
What does being an adult mean in that context? Does it mean Democrats might try to force a vote, maybe on the last day of session, using a motion to end debate that would allow a quote unquote clean FRA? Like, what does like being an adult mean for you in this context when you're saying that?
I think it's about Democrats and Republicans coming together and recognizing that we have a duty to pass a budget and a clean FRA. It's happened 17 times. So there should not be any reason that we disrupt that process based on precedent. And again, if we do something that, again, is hyperpartisan or pandering to a small group of senators who have hijacked the process over the years, I think it would be very unfortunate. And that's what I mean by being adults.
No, the hearing on the FRA, which happened way, way, way earlier in session, it got contentious, not only between Democrats, but also some Republicans joining Democrats and expressing frustration over what would be anti, you know, Planned Parenthood language, saying like, I think it was Senator Crawford at the time saying, what else do you want us to do? We've banned abortion in the state. This is not related to that. I remember she expressed frustration. I think Senator Seaport did as well as Democrats. So what are your thoughts that there's still kind of this push for this language, even though right now abortion is more or less illegal in Missouri?
Well, I think, again, it comes back to, are we going to allow someone to take a childish perspective and say that our state is promoting or the Senate is doing something that it's not, just to project this onto voters to try to win an election is completely inappropriate, in my opinion. So, again, it's going to be important for senators in a bipartisan way, which has to happen in the Senate for us to pass bills for the most part. A bipartisan coalition of serious senators that want to get this done. And I think the state will be grateful for it. I think our constituents will be happy, especially those that are on Medicaid, those that are on fixed incomes. They'll be extremely grateful and proud that there were representatives and senators that represent them that stood up and did the right thing.
Is there any scenario where Democrats would allow an FRA to go through that does have those restrictions, or is it more of a situation? I know one of the possibilities is maybe passing a separate bill restricting funds to Planned Parenthood and leaving the FRA alone. Kind of thoughts on what that if there is a compromise, what that might be?
Well, I can tell you, you know, the Democratic caucus in the Senate has stood firm by the fact that we need to pass a clean FRA. And that's something that we've done every year that I've been in the Senate. We've stood firm against any anti-abortion language. We've stood firm against any anti-access to birth control language. And that's what I anticipate that we'll do this year as well.
Is there a different compromise, or right now the version of the FRA does not have a sunset? It would just, you would never have to do this process again in theory. Is a possible other compromise maybe having a sunset on it, maybe not 3 years, but 5 years? Thoughts on that?
I think we should extend the sunset because, again, it's something that we have to get done. And I don't think the legislature should be bogged down with every couple of years. And usually it falls on an election year. Having to deal with this, I think we should focus on really figuring out how to either extend the sunset or maybe even remove it to where, again, this becomes a part of the process that we get done, knowing that it has to happen, and we don't bog the entire legislative session down because of it.
And this is my last question on this, and it's a little personal question in a way. Am I going to be here in June because the legislature isn't able to get it done in time and we're doing a special session?
Well, you know, I'm an optimistic person, and I really have benefited from being positive in what a lot of people deem as a not so positive and negative political environment. I do really think we can get it done, and I do not anticipate either one of us being here in June.
We'll be right back on Politically Speaking with State Senator Brian Williams.
The Gateway brings you the day's news from the St. Louis region and across Missouri. It also includes stories from the Illinois side of the river and our Metro East reporter, Will Bauer.
In Alton, in Belleville, in East St. Louis, in Edwardsville, in Cahokia Heights, at Scott Air Force Base, I'm Will Bauer, St. Louis Public Radio.
Listen to reports from Will and all of our journalists weekdays on the Gateway, on the STLPR app, and wherever you get podcasts.
And we're back on Politically Speaking with State Senator Brian Williams. He represents the St. Louis County-based 14th Senatorial District in the Missouri Senate. Let's move on to criminal justice matters. You've been working on legislation regarding expungement. I believe it is called the Clean Slate Eligible Offenses Bill. Can you talk about how the bill would work and what it would do?
Yeah, so clean slate expungement is essentially an automatic expungement. And it became something that I prioritized because of the fact that we have people who have made mistakes at some point in their life, have served their debt to society, and now are back in society and can't find a quality job, can't make a livable wage, and can't do all the things that are required to be a model citizen. And I felt that considering the fact that our state loses out on a lot of money because of the fact that we don't have a thriving workforce, because of the fact that folks have not been positioned to go back into society and be model citizens because they can't get a job, they can't get access to housing, they can't, again, do the fundamental things that we need to do to thrive as people. So I filed this legislation. We've seen it done in other states like Pennsylvania. And we've seen it really take their workforce, but the morale and folks who have, again, been in the criminal justice system to the next level. And that's something that we're hoping to be able to do here in Missouri as well.
How is this bill different from other expungement efforts over the past couple of years?
Well, again, you know, we want to make sure that this is clear to folks. This isn't a get out of jail free card. This is already a population of Missourians that are eligible for an expungement. The problem is that there's such a daunting process. It's expensive, meaning you have to hire an attorney. The process is long, and there's still a 50-50 chance that you are even considered for that expungement. So again, it's such an expensive and long and drawn out process for anyone. So imagine if you're poor. Imagine if you're on limited funds. It's almost virtually impossible to get an expungement. And I like to really paint a picture for the listeners. You know, I met a woman who was in defense of herself in a domestic violence situation. She was charged with armed criminal action because she was defending herself, had a firearm. It was not a homicide. And that has now been on her record since 1984, roughly since some of us were born. And she has raised two children. One is a physician. One is a lawyer. Both went to Ivy League schools. And to this day, both of their names is on her lease because she cannot get any type of housing on her own. She has not been in any trouble since then, over 40 years almost. And she's raised model children that are now adults. And to this day, they still have to sign off on a lease for their mom to get access to housing because she has something on her record.
This legislation has Republican support. Senator Curtis Trent sponsored a similar bill, and Representatives Phil Christopher and Justin Hicks are pushing for this bill in the House. Why do you think this idea has GOP buy-in?
Well, I think, again, it's not a partisan position, and we should have a common goal in our state to focus on, again, restorative justice, putting folks in position to be model citizens, advancing our workforce, addressing issues around recidivism to where we do not put people on a trajectory to go back to prison. And the simple fact, again, I come from a community and represent a region where folks have made mistakes for a myriad of reasons, and those should not follow them. They should get a fair chance to right that wrong. And again, this isn't a get out of jail free pass. This is a population of people who are already eligible for an expungement. They're nonviolent offenses. And we really need to get this across the finish line because I think it's going to take our state and our workforce to the next level.
Yeah. How realistic is it getting past the finish line this year with the Senate, especially with possible gridlock and the budget and the FRA and kind of some big items still left on the to-do list?
Well, I mean, I passed high profile and really big criminal justice reform bills in the past. You know, we filed the my police reform bill 2 years ago, and we got that through the legislature. And it had a myriad of things that have been able to contribute to the upward trajectory of the criminal justice system post-Ferguson. So, you know, I feel really positive that we can get it done. And again, if not, you know, I'm looking forward to continue to work with folks to get it done in the future.
And speaking of some of that legislation in the past, you know, you sponsor legislation that expanded restitution for people whose sentences were vacated after they're determined to be innocent. That bill made it through the legislature, but ultimately was vetoed by Governor Mike Parson. Why do you think, you know, is this worth trying again? Why do you think this is worth trying again?
Well, anything that moves our state forward and help everyday Missourians is worth doing it. That's why we do this work. And, you know, we passed that bill a year ago, Senate Bill 189, and the governor decided to veto it. I did talk with the governor and he expressed his concerns and I expressed mine. And we made an agreement to run that bill back this year and try to get it across the finish line. Unfortunately, we have not done that, but I feel really positive about it. And again, this was simply a bill that I focused on having an opportunity to pass legislation with the motion to vacate, which was the bill that allowed people like Lamar Johnson and Kevin Strickland to become free men. And to meet Lamar and spend time with him and work with folks with the Innocence Project and to learn more about them as people, I felt that it was only right for them to get some form of restitution, considering the fact that they were wrongfully convicted and sent to prison for crimes they did not commit. So it was really kind of personal for me to try to get that for them and countless other exonerees that we don't know. But we'll keep trying. And again, it was unfortunate that we passed it and it was vetoed.
You know, Parson said in his veto message that he didn't like the idea of the state paying for something that was the fault of local prosecutors. On this podcast, Senator Tony Lueckemeyer, who's the head of the Judiciary Committee, he didn't agree with that logic. I'm curious about what you think about it.
Well, you know, it's no secret. Senator Lueckemeyer and I worked really close on some really big criminal justice reform issues, been able to get it done in a bipartisan way. And I share that sentiment. We both understood exactly what we were trying to accomplish with that bill. And, you know, the governor, you know, he has a right to his perspective. And, you know, that is what it is. But we didn't see it that way.
Is this something that you think would have greater momentum under a different administration? Let's just say that.
Well, I think that, again, you know, and I know we'll talk about elections a little bit, but, you know, I've learned not to really base policy on elections. And, you know, again, it's still pretty unpredictable. But I do think, you know, there are some people out there that are on the ballot that can potentially help us get this done.
All right. Let's segue into political stuff. Let's just talk about you for a second before we move to other people. You decided not to put your name on the ballot, even though you were connected to the first congressional district race. What made you come to that decision? And are you overjoyed that you do not have to participate in what could be the ugliest election cycle in Missouri history?
Well, first, yes and yes. And, you know, it was a very difficult decision for me, solely because of the fact that I enjoy service. And, you know, I've always wanted to represent the region. And I felt like I had the experience and the relationships and the understanding of what it took to go to Congress and be a tremendous advocate for our region. The other side of it is throughout that process, I became a father. And being a dad has been by far one of the coolest titles I've ever had. And it exceeds a state senator every single time. And, you know, growing up without a dad in my life, I felt it was so important to be the best father that I can be day one. And that's really difficult to do and run for public office at the same time. In terms of the election, you know, I've been very fortunate to have only had to run one time in almost 6 years. And that's not by accident. That's because of the fact that I've been able to establish really good relationships with my colleagues at the state and local level and federal level. And that's something that I think is really important. And I hope that other elected officials start to value that sentiment. And again, you know, I don't know what's going to happen in August, but I think the voters are going to have to make a decision on what they want the future of Congressional District, Missouri Congressional District 1 to look like. And they have three candidates that they can pick from.
So there are three candidates in the race that are major: Congresswoman Cori Bush, St. Louis County Prosecutor Wesley Bell, and former State Senator Maria Chappelle Nadal. And the way I see this race, since this is a majority-minority district where Black voters, I think, have the majority, the winner of this race is going to be the person that can win places like your district and North St. Louis City and other places which are predominantly African-American. I think that there is an assumption that this race is going to be around Congresswoman Bush's position on Israel and Palestine. But I've talked with a lot of Black voters, and I don't get the sense that's a major issue for them. Now, I'm just a white dude who lives in the second congressional district, so I'm not an expert on this. And I'm sure you've talked with Black voters every day since you've been elected. How big of an issue is the conflict in Israel and in Gaza for the first district? And is it going to be a determinative issue in this race?
Well, yeah, that's a great question. And I'll say first, you know, of all three candidates, I've never had a personal issue or really any instance where I felt like we couldn't or didn't have an opportunity to work together. So, you know, I've never been in a position to have a personal opinion. However, I do think that elections should be and hopefully are really judged by folks' record and their record of service and most importantly, how they treat people, not just their constituents, but how they engage with folks across the board. I don't think that Israel is going to be as important of an issue as folks may have thought it would have been. As someone who has represented the Jewish community the entire time I've been in elected office, I've been very grateful and proud of the relationship I've been able to establish. But I hope folks understand that that community is not monolithic, and they have never really expected me to be the voice for Israel. They've always just expected me to be an ally and be someone that they can work with and know that I'm going to be thoughtful to their issues and represent them like any other constituent. So any candidate that thinks that carrying the banner for Israel when none of us have any control over what the complexity or what the outcome is going to be pertaining to Gaza. As someone who's been to the Middle East and been to Israel multiple times, it's a very complex region. It's a very complex situation. And I think it's really important for the candidates to really focus on clearly denouncing what happened on October 7th, because Hamas, the actions taken should be called out, and it should be made clear that any terrorist attack on any people in our world should be denounced. But in terms of being the subject matter expert when it comes to Israel, I don't think that's going to make the difference in this election.
So a couple quick hits on some other races. U.S. Senate is basically a race between Lucas Kuntz and your colleague, State Senator Carla May, the official state senator of Jason Rosenbaum, by the way. Do you think that she can increase her fundraising to be competitive, given that there are a lot of people in the Missouri political world that really like her and want her to succeed, but they're looking at how much money Lucas Kuntz has raised, and they're like, this is not going to be much of a race unless things change.
Yeah, that's a really good point you made. First, with that race, it's really difficult to count Carla May out just because of the fact that she's been through tough elections. And Carla and I came into the Senate together, and I remember us both running at the same time. And if you were to ask the pundits or the political observers who was going to win that state Senate race, it was not Carla May. So that ability to work through those type of elections is something that she's just been known to do. So it's hard to count her out. But also the reality of elections is they cost money. They're very, very expensive, especially statewide. And Lucas Kuntz has been able to do something that was very impressive fundraising wise. And I think that should be something that's noted, especially from the Democratic Party and from our side for future elections. What he's been able to do, whether it's raising small dollar amounts or even getting people invested to contribute large sums of money, has been really impressive. And I hope that the party take notes from what he's been able to do. In terms of the election outcome, it's going to be very difficult to predict just because of the fact, again, you know, have some voters that come out and they vote based on name ID and who they know. Some vote because they simply want to see a woman in a statewide office. Some vote because they have some connection to one of those candidates. And both of them have upsides that can make the case on why they'll be successful. So we'll see. But I do think that those are two really good candidates, and whoever comes out that primary is going to be fun to watch in the general.
Now, before Sarah asks her question, one of the nice things about this race is I get a sense Lucas Kuntz and Carla May do not hate each other, and this may be one of the more civil primaries this August. I could be wrong.
They're both good people, and, you know, that's always positive when you can look at a race and say at the end of the day, there's just two good people running. And voters have an opportunity to decide who they want to be their nominee for November.
You know, moving on to the governor's race, do you think Missouri Democrats have any chance at all at competing in that race? And if so, who do you think is the better candidate, Representative Crystal Quaid or Mike Hamra?
Well, again, you know, primaries are always difficult because it's about one party figuring out who's the best candidate for visions and ideology that's very, very similar. In terms of the governor's race, as in terms of the primary, you know, I haven't gotten to know Mike Hamra. Clearly, I'll learn about him throughout this election cycle. So I don't think it's fair for me to really speak to his capability or his background just because we haven't had an opportunity to engage. But I will say, serving in the legislature with Crystal Quaid, she's been tremendous in the House. And I think that she's been very intentional about advancing democratic values in the House. And I think that's something that she'll take with her in this race. And that's something that she needs to get credit for, which is a very, very difficult job. And I'm sure she's talked about it on here with you all, but she's also taken the initiative to pick up seats throughout our state in very tough House districts where Democrats were trying to flip Republican districts. So, you know, Crystal, she has every reason to run, and she has every right to run. And I think that the work she's put in over the years will help her tremendously in this primary. But again, I think it's going to still come down to who can get their message out and who has a message that resonates with voters.
Jamie Harrison, who's the party chair of the National Democratic Party, he had a tweet that he issued, let me look, about in late March, congratulating the Democrats on recruitment. And I just want to read one of his statistics here, which he said was 88%, which is 15 out of 17 state Senate seats, had a candidate, Democratic candidate. And then 83%, so that's 135 out of 163 state House seats were filled with candidates. And he compared that to 2022, when there were only 90 state House seats filled. So that is quite an increase. What are your thoughts on the fact that more candidates, there's less, you know, one party's only running bit, the fact that these seats are becoming, quote unquote, more competitive? For just State House Missouri.
Oh, it's huge. And that's why we should give credit to the House Democrats, because they're finding people to run and challenge Republicans throughout the state. And again, hopefully move our state to a more balanced government. We've seen where you have a supermajority, it makes it very difficult to get, in my opinion, balanced and common sense policies across the finish line. And again, if we can balance that out, I think it really takes our state to a more productive conversation. But again, that goes back to the House Democrats. You know, Crystal's played a big role in that, and clearly countless other members of the House that's dedicated time, energy, traveling all over the state to ensure that they're helping and supporting candidates. And I'm glad that Jamie Harrison noticed that, because that's a positive thing for our state.
Well, thank you, Senator, for your time, as always. Politically Speaking is a product of St. Louis Public Radio, which, as we mentioned in the podcast, is a product of the University of Missouri, St. Louis. You can read all of our coverage at stlpr.org. And, Senator, is there anywhere on social media that you would point our listeners to where you want to be found?
So this is a little bit tricky. So clearly I'm on Facebook, Brian Williams. I'm on Instagram, B Williams MO. You know, between my friction with Elon Musk and the fact that we're teaching our son about limited screen time, I have taken a break from X or Twitter, whatever it's called, but I am Brian Williams MO on there, and maybe I'll resurface at some point. But right now I'm enjoying less screen time and really just focused on advancing our region and doing everything I can to serve you all in the Senate.
Thank you very much. And until next time, so long. Politically Speaking is produced by Sarah Kellogg, Rachel Lipman, and me, Jason Rosenbaum. The show is edited by Fred Ehrlich. Read all of our coverage at stlpr.org. And if you haven't already, make sure to subscribe to Politically Speaking by searching the term Politically Speaking on Apple Podcasts. From St. Louis Public Radio. This is Politically Speaking.
If you have a smart speaker, you have access to the entire world of NPR and St. Louis Public Radio. All the latest news and all the captivating stories. Activate our voices with yours by telling your smart speaker to play St. Louis Public Radio.